I'm here in the studio with Jonathan Lerna, a Hudson resident, a writer who writes about architecture and art and food and travel. But he had a previous life back in the late 60s and early 70s as a member of SDS and then the Weather Underground. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. I should say that we're here because you've just written a book called Swords in the Hand of Children.
Right.
Published by Or Press.
Or Books.
Or Books, I'm sorry. And is it out yet?
Yes. I am told that people are receiving their copies right today, yesterday
and
today.
And you're going to do a book signing here locally in Hudson on June 11th?
June 11th at the Opera House.
At the Opera House at what time?
5 p.m.
5 p.m. Well, this is a long story in a way. And I think we need to go over a little bit of historical background if we're going to make sense of it.
Okay.
You joined SDS as a student at Antioch in the late 60s. You, inspired by a close friend, you joined SDS, correct?
My close friend and I dropped out of school together. Well, at the same time, both moved to New York. I thought I was going to do theater. He moved there in order to be on the regional staff of SDS, but within a few months, he had pulled me in.
For our younger listeners, and it's sad to say they might not know, but SDS stands for Students for a Democratic Society, which was really one of the great participatory democracy movements in our time that really started in the mid-60s with, I guess you could say, with the Port Huron Statement, which had been largely written by Tom Hayden, who was a student at Michigan at the time. And by the time you were involved, it was already suffering growing pains.
It was suffering growing pains because we were suffering the war in Vietnam. By the time I got into it in 67, that was the year there were 500,000 American soldiers in Vietnam. It already was clearly an unwinnable war. And already there was a big mass movement against it, of which SDS was a leading factor. And
also in the civil rights movement.
Well, in the civil rights movement, which probably was the original spark for SDS, actually.
A lot of the early SDS members had actually been freedom riders and
gone south to gone do south voter to do, registration. Yeah.
And of course, one of the famous excerpts of the Port Huron Statement was about how the generation of young people at the time felt that this post-war prosperity was kind of it really wasn't satisfying.
It wasn't satisfying, and it also it masked a reality.
Right.
I mean, if you look at my life, my grandparents were all immigrants. My parents both went through college. My father worked for the State Department. We lived in an affluent suburb of Washington. I went to a private high school. Everything seemed to be kind of perfect for us, and yet on television we saw people being fire-hosed and tear gassed because they wanted to register to vote. And we saw people being burned to death in Vietnam by firebombs dropped by American planes. And it was a disconnect, that a rupture in our view of the country we'd been told was perfect.
And, you know, the sort of handbooks of the time, or let's say the sociologists who wrote about things at the time, like Paul Goodwin and C. Wright Mills, were all talking about alienated youth. I mean, this was a kind of a high point for young people to feel that they were just left out of decision-making, that this war was taking place without any other than being used as fodder for the war.
Yeah, and aside from politically, culturally, I think we looked at our parents' generation and we thought, what is this? We don't want this. I mean, this is the source of the counterculture, of people dropping out. Drugs and rock and roll were a part of it, but it was about creating an alternative. A lot of us, naively thinking we could kind of live as hippies for the rest of our lives, but it was definitely a reaction to what we saw as a soulless future for ourselves.
So SDS was growing at the time you were involved, and eventually kind of self-destructed. This is a kind of not a technical story, but it involves a lot of the ins and outs of kind of left-wing theory and practice. And I know the famous various gatherings in 68 and 69 when various factions were in competition. Can you give us like a little summary of that, what happened?
Well, there's a thing that happens. It seems to happen on the left in particular. Maybe
the
it
left
happens.
Eats its own. The revolution eats
Yeah. This group thinks they have a more perfect analysis than that group, and the people who were your comrades a minute ago suddenly are all wrong. And there's, you know, some of this is driven not by politics, but by
personality.
People's yeah. need to be correct.
Oh, right.
People's need to have the loudest voice in the room. And bear in mind that the people we're talking about were all in their late teens and early 20s. So not much perspective, really. And that's a thing that's happened in movements. You know, I'm not a historian, but that's something I'm aware of having happened in movements, and certainly
yeah.
in ours.
I am sort of an amateur historian of radical movements. And you know, it reminds me of what Irving Howe complained about the New Left, was that it was new. And part of their newness was that they ignored sort of the failures of left movements in the past. And one of those failures was how to deal with the sectarianism. And when the more radical groups would try to take over. In New York, and in the SDS case, the sort of hardliners were the progressive labor movement, who really were a throwback, sort of a Maoist throwback movement.
They could have been saying the same things in 1930
right.
or in 1890. Everyone should clean up and get factory jobs and organize the proletariat. And whereas
and cut their hair and start
cut your hair,
straight.
Stop doing drugs. Yeah. And whereas a lot of the rest of us wanted to like sort of blow everything wide open
yeah.
and experiment with new identities. And we called ourselves, or we thought of ourselves, as the New Left. Very much in contrast to that kind of stuffy,
right.
old-fashioned, which at the time was represented by the Soviet Union, too,
sure.
which seemed like not a place anyone would actually aspire to live.
So we've kind of given a little bit of the historical background. Now let's get to you.
So
you first kind of dealt with, I mean, you didn't really write or talk about this for many, many years. We're talking almost 50 years ago now.
Yeah.
But you did essay a version of events in a novel about 8 years ago?
8 or 10 years
called
ago.
Called Alex Underground.
Right.
But now you've decided to just say what really happened in terms of doing it as a memoir of your time in the movement.
Actually, I thought I had said and written everything I had to say about this experience.
In the novel?
In the novel and in some other things I had written earlier.
Oh, you did. Oh.
A publisher I know, because he bought a novel from me 30 years ago, asked me to write a memoir now because of what's been happening now. This was about a year ago, before the election. But because of the obvious growth of activism and this sort of leaderlessness mm-hmm. of the lack of leadership
once again,
and clarity.
Leftists seem to be
flailing around.
Yes, flailing and sectarian arguing. And
so this publisher thought that this is a good time for this book, partly because people are interested in the history that I lived, but also because people are looking for lessons.
So this was the publisher at Serpent's Tail when you published your first novel?
Well, it's more complicated than that.
Your first novel, Caught in a Still Place, which I read recently and thought was fantastic, by the way.
Thank you.
But
that's that novel, but he was working for a different publisher.
Anyway, back to how this came about.
So he said, would you write this? And I said, well, I think I don't have anything else to say about it, but if you're serious about it, let's get together and talk, and maybe you can provoke me to do it. And he said, I'm dead serious. We made a date. And by the time I got to his office 2 weeks later, my wheels were already turning. And 5 months later, I handed in the manuscript. He wanted to publish it really quickly because of what's happening
mm-hmm.
now. And mm-hmm. So here we are today.
So let's go into your personal story of your engagement with the movement. You start out in SDS in New York City. And I guess we could talk about one of the major players right away, and that is Jeff Jones, who was your fellow Antioch student, and who, by the way, I think lives upstate somewhere.
Last I knew, he lived in Albany.
Yeah. I'm not sure how to... So I guess we can get right to the punchline. It was kind of a... There were personal motives beyond... I don't know how to say this any clear way. The personal motives beyond your political commitments had a lot to do with Jeff Jones.
Yeah, and actually not just me allowing myself to be brought into SDS by Jeff, but many other decisions I subsequently made were made because of personal loyalty and friendship. Mm-hmm. Jeff and I were really good friends. I think I was in love with him, actually. Mm-hmm. We used to joke that I was the arty one and he was the political one, and that it was a good balance. And actually, when I was organized onto the staff by some friends of his, actually he wasn't even in the room at the time, they enticed me onto the staff by saying, we need you to go to the campus chapters and organize guerrilla theater groups, because I had been doing radical theater in the streets.
I remember that. the kids who do the die-ins today over Black Lives Matter have no clue what it was like, the die-ins during the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
That was a big activist thing to do.
Yeah.
And guerrilla theater of other sorts.
I was with a group in New York that we had a little play called Johnny 1A. If you were 1A, it meant you were next up to be drafted to go into the service and to Vietnam, probably. And we had a little skit called Johnny 1A about a kid who gets 1A, and he gets classified 1A, and he goes to war. And there was a symbolic little toy Ford Thunderbird, which was his vehicle to get to war in, and we danced around, and he crashed, and that was the end of Johnny 1A. We went around to parks and things like that and did this thing, and then handed out leaflets to get people to come to demonstrations.
Having had two older brothers who were war eligible, I recall the sheer panic. I mean, I don't even know if younger people understand today what a draft meant, but it put every male of a certain age into a total state of fear.
Everybody had to register.
Even those who were sort of pro-Vietnam, I think, were.
Well, were, yeah. I mean, I don't think too many people actually eagerly wanted to go.
Yeah, exactly. That's
a lot of people felt obligated and felt it was their responsibility, right, and whatever, but. Yeah, this is a lot of the reason why the student movement was so huge by 1967 and 1968, is that every one of us was liable to be drafted. There had been student deferments, but when they ran out of people who weren't students, they started drafting people who were students, reclassifying U1A. And in order to not be inducted, you had to either fail a medical exam or you had to be determined that you were crazy or homosexual, or you had to have pull if your father was, a high official somewhere.
George Bush Sr.
Yeah, for example. Then you might either...
Dan Quayle.
You might get to go into the Coast Guard, which was an easy place to be because they weren't at war, or you might just never get reclassified 1A. But for the masses of young guys, it was hanging over our heads, and... young women, if they wanted to serve, couldn't have served, which probably was one irritant to some of them. And also, it was just a disruption to the whole, your community was liable to be ripped in half.
So you got involved with SDS and you were assigned to do guerrilla theater. How did that evolve into what comes next?
Well, there wasn't really much interest in the campus chapters for doing guerrilla theater. So I visited a few of them a few times, and that didn't happen. But there, I already was on the staff. I was a member of the staff. It was what I was doing. We had an office I went to every day.
Now, were people like Carl Oglesby already out of the whole picture? Or?
Well, Carl's a sort of half-generation older, so he was an earlier person. But I was at sort of at the younger end. I mean, we're talking about...
He was sort of one of the older... He wasn't even a university student. He had been an engineer, I believe, right?
He'd worked at Ford or something.
Yeah.
I was 18 or 19 at the time. And on the staff in New York when I joined, I was probably the youngest person, and the oldest person might have been 25 or 26.
It's so funny, because when I found out about you writing this in your past, I was like, he can't be that old. You know, because I know you, and you don't look over 70, and you're not over 70. The point is, you were really young, even compared to, and in those days, 5 or 6 years.
It did make a difference.
Made a big difference.
Yeah. So anyway, the guerrilla theater thing didn't pan out, but then there I was, and there was stuff to do. You know, there was leaflets to run off, and demonstrations to organize, and conferences to organize, and I was there in New York on the staff. For most of a year, and then I went back to Washington and lived in an SDS collective house where we had a regional office also and organized among the college chapters at the universities there. And at the end of that year, which is that school year, which is this June of 1969, was the last real conference of SDS when the organization split apart, partly because we, the Weathermen, emerged and kicked the rest of them out.
So that's the next chapter of this, in terms of time, relatively short story. The Weathermen evolved. The Weathermen, eventually calls themselves the Weather Underground to make it a little less sexist. And, of course, Jeff Jones, Bill Ayers, and Bernardine Dorn are the sort of celebrity members of the group.
They're the well-known ones now. Yeah. There were 10 or 11 people who wrote a position paper for that conference in June 1969, and the title of it was borrowed from Bob Dylan, as is the title of my book.
By way of the Bible. It's a biblical quotation. Yeah.
I wouldn't know. the title of the paper was "You Don't Need a Weatherman to Know Which Way the Wind Blows," which was a kind of snotty way of saying to our comrades of a few months before, "You guys don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
We know," and which
is a kind of another form of sectarianism in the sense that it goes back to the whole revolutionary vanguard idea, and that you could somehow lead. I mean,
we're more advanced than you. Right. We get it, and you don't. And
will it be the working class, the lumpen proletariat, or the revolutionary vanguard? I mean, these are kind of ideas that have.
And our idea was it was kids. It was kids in the streets.
Right.
It was working class greasers who already knew how to fight. We liked that because we talked about fighting, but we weren't very good at it because we were sort of mostly cosseted upper middle class kids or middle class kids. As a result of that, it's a complicated story how it happened, but at that conference, we sort of seized control of the organization and the national apparatus, which was a national office, printing presses, membership files.
Of SDS.
Of SDS.
Were then taken over by the Weather Underground. Or
well,
the Weatherman.
By the Weatherman faction at that time. And we proceeded with our idea that the thing to do was to provoke fights in the streets with the police. So for about 6 months, basically, that's what we did. We had collectives in six or eight cities that had meant to be summer organizing projects. A lot of the members of them were still registered students. They were just on their summer holiday. We sort of forged these collectives into this kind of fighting force, and the groups would like go out and take a stand in a public park and sort of start saying provocative things and either fight with people or try to get people to agree with them. And by the end of 6 or 8 months, a lot of us had been arrested for doing this in various ways, and a lot of people had charges against them. And also, this strategy had not worked. We had not actually attracted masses and masses of young people to our idea that fighting the police in the streets was the way to build a revolution. And so we were really isolated and really resentful. And that the isolation and the resentment, plus the legal charges, plus this kind of insistent vision of revolution as a military process that we got from the Cubans and the Vietnamese and the Chinese, Che Guevara trying to start a revolutionary army in the jungle of Bolivia.
I'm mildly embarrassed to say I had a Che Guevara poster up in my bedroom.
Well, I mean,
drove my father insane.
He's another celebrity.
Yeah, and, right.
He was handsome.
Exactly.
But, all of those things together led to this idea of building an underground.
Right.
Importantly and often overlooked being the resentment and the isolation.
Of the group that went underground.
Yeah, on the part of those of us who formed the underground, resenting the fact that the rest of the new left wasn't with us. And so therefore, you know, they're full of it. They're not trustworthy.
So
they're not.
when do you think the idea to go even further with what some have described as terrorist activity in terms of destruction of property and in a couple cases, people dying? How did that evolve?
Well, I think it's all of a piece if your model is the Cuban Revolution, which, you know, was started by a small group of people, I think, I don't know, 30 or 40 people, doing like I think they started by attacking a military arms depot to try and get weapons.
And of course, one of the major incidents was actually I don't think it was was the main faction, but at the University of Wisconsin, where a building was bombed because it was doing military research,
right.
And there happened to be was it a janitor? Was
there? No, there was a graduate student
who was
pulling an all-nighter.
Yeah.
Well, there were also, it's important to remember that there were lots of bombings and bomb threats and firebombings coming from the left in those years. Actually,
right.
If you, the numbers are sort of startling, like thousands of them.
I know. Brian Burroughs documents a lot of it in his book, Days of Rage, in which you're quoted, by the way. And I was shocked by how many bombings.
Yeah.
And of course, most of them were about property. And of course, the most famous one was really a sad story. Well, some would say it's not a sad story. Some would say it's deserving. But it was, once again, the revolution eating its own, which was the 14th, was it 14th Street or 8th Street?
11th Street. 11th
Street.
Townhouse.
Townhouse. You want to tell that story?
Which, well, that was us. And by the end of 1969, resentful, isolated, and still with this idea of a military victory in mind, we started to build an underground and started to acquire explosives and guns and things like that. And one group was assembling bombs which were aimed for an ROTC dance. In other words, a social event involving young people in the military. And these were anti-personnel bombs with basically dynamite and nails meant to do a lot of physical destruction to people. And they weren't careful, or something happened, and they blew themselves up as they were assembling the bombs. So three of my ex-comrades killed themselves that way.
You knew them all pretty well, right?
I knew them all, some better than others.
Yeah. Teddy Gold, I remember, is one of
Teddy Gold was the one I knew the best. Diana Otten and Terry Robbins. This was a sort of logical conclusion of the path we'd been on, and I don't think there's any question that at that time, anyway, this was terrorism. I mean, it was intended to kill and maim innocent people.
Billy Ayers, of course, denies that aspect, right? I mean,
so I'm told. I actually haven't read his books.
He seems to take less responsibility than you do in your book, which I'm sure I should make clear to everyone. In fact, at one point, I believe you characterized the Weathermen as secretive, intellectually stultifying, corrupt, and violent. And yet you stayed for a while.
I stayed it for 7 years.
So tell us how the whole underground aspect begins with the violent activity, right?
Yeah.
And what determines... what forces people to go underground, which is to say to live off the grid, to try to escape? I mean, people were being sought by the FBI.
People were being sought by the FBI.
For?
Well, for the charges that they had gotten fighting in the streets, but then also there were then two... Well, and that whole period I was describing, then there were two federal conspiracy trials also, which had to do, one had to do with a conspiracy to provoke riots, which was for the above ground period, and then one had to do with a conspiracy to do bombings. So a number of people.
So
then,
none of them were for the actual bombings.
No, I don't believe so.
And I guess that's why eventually they didn't really do much time when they did come back above ground.
That's right. Also, the federal conspiracy about bombings, if I'm not mistaken, was eventually dropped because of misconduct on the part of the FBI and the way they collected evidence and things like that.
That's a whole other story that could take forever, but there's plenty of literature on it. I never knew how to pronounce it. COINTELPRO?
Is that
it? COINTELPRO,
yeah.
Which is the campaign to...
It stands for Counterintelligence Program. It was the FBI's program of inserting informers and doing what I guess we'd call psychological warfare now.
They used it against Martin Luther King. They used it against...
against the New Left, against the Civil Rights, Black Movement and Civil Rights Movement.
And didn't you... can't recall, but didn't you become pretty familiar with it, a member or two of that, as in it, who was planted among your people?
Well, you know, I know that I knew people who were plants, but I actually still don't know who they were.
Oh, okay.
Well, actually, I know who one or two of them were. Yeah. I mean, you know, if we had sort of accepted them in, we accepted them in.
But, I mean, there is an argument to be made that some of them were more vocal in promoting violence, that they were actually trying to amp up things in order to create. I mean, I'm not saying there wasn't willingness on the part of the members of the underground.
Right.
But there was definitely provocation.
I think so. There was, I mean, it was certainly about informing anyway. Mm-hmm. Well, then here we are after the townhouse,
mm-hmm.
When I think people were sort of horrified, partly by the fact that three of our own people had killed themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't really part of the plan, and it sort of forced people to go underground sooner than they had planned. But there was a sort of backing off. There wasn't a backing off from doing bombings. The organization continued to do bombings for the next 5 or 6 years, but not very many, and very, very targeted ones that were not targeted at people. They were targeted at what you could call symbolic targets, like there was a bomb set off in a restroom at the U.S. Capitol. There was a bomb set off at the Pentagon, some corporate headquarters, some bank headquarters. More propagandistic in intention. I mean, mm-hmm. then there's the question, is this terrorism or not? And it's some people say the terrorism ended when the townhouse blew up and people thought better of these kinds of indiscriminate acts, and some people say we were terrorists the whole time. And actually, I think the point is it's less important to decide if and when exactly we were and weren't terrorists as to talk about our contribution to the general atmosphere of violence and militants, and the idea that this is a good way to conduct political discourse, which these days I don't think so.
So at one point you're named as an unindicted co-conspirator, which you make fun of in the novel. It's a funny little sequence, because it's not even clear what that means in terms of the consequences for you.
It wasn't clear to me at
right.
the time.
So you go underground.
Right.
What's the first place you go to?
Well, my story is a little unusual because at the time that the organization was preparing to go underground, I was sent to Cuba. There was actually, I believe there still is, an organization called the Venceremos Brigade, which sends groups of American leftists to do work projects in Cuba. And I was on the second of those groups in early 1970. About 30 or 40 people who had been in Weatherman were sent there. I think partly because the leadership they were mostly people. Leadership wasn't sure, do we want to bring these particular individuals underground with us? Are we really sure about them? So it was a sort of...
the leaders were actually named conspirators, so they were truly like on the FBI's wanted list.
So I was in Cuba when this indictment came down, which made it... I mean, if I'd been in this country, I would have just talked to a lawyer and said, what does it mean that I'm an unindicted co-conspirator? And the answer was, it doesn't really mean anything. Maybe mm-hmm. I would be called to testify, but I wasn't charged with anything. But I didn't know, and actually, even if I had just used my own logic, I might have thought that the term unindicted co-conspirator meant I was not indicted.
Right.
But it was more romantic and sort of dramatic to imagine that, I'm in this mysterious status now. I better be really careful, and I better not go back to the United States. So instead of returning with the rest of the Venceremos Brigade to the U.S., or actually to Canada, because we had to go from Canada because at the time you couldn't travel directly to Cuba. I talked the Cubans into sending me to Europe.
There was already an underground of draft resistors, right?
Well, there was I'm not sure you would call it an organized underground, but there was, there were many guys who went AWOL from the service because of their opposition to the war. And there were many other people who, rather than allowing themselves to be drafted, went to places like Canada or just other countries mm-hmm. so that they wouldn't be drafted. So my idea, and Sweden in particular, had been a haven for deserters to go to. That was a well-known thing. So my idea was I would go to Sweden and try to find help among the deserters who would be able to give me help me find false ID or political support, and then to come back to this country under a different identity, since I was in this kind of self-glorifying way pretending that I was liable to be arrested if I came back under my own identity.
And I have to say, in the memoir, you're pretty unrelenting in self-criticism, which others who have written memoirs at the period have been accused of not being.
Just telling the story.
Yeah.
The way
right,
I remember
just, it. Right. So you come back, and start, I can't remember if you're above ground when you start doing all the printing work and all that. Or is that before? I'm getting my chronology.
Well, oh, you mean, no.
Prairie Fire is before or after?
Prairie Fire was later, but when I was at the National Office in 1969, after when we took over the NO, and I'm that's what we called it, when I went to Chicago from Washington, I very quickly became the editor of our newspaper and sort of the editor of our publications, basically.
A lot of them are available online now.
Some of them have been collected in anthologies, brochures, leaflets, posters. And SDS had always had, a very sort of staid gray, probably 8-page biweekly national newspaper, which we quickly turned into this kind of wild, colorful. Sometimes it was just one folded piece of paper that was meant to be a poster. With violent images and rock and roll lyrics all over it.
So I was looking at some of them online, and I thought, I don't see Jonathan's name, because you used the name of a relatively obscure young man who, I think, put a stone on a train track in California. What's that story again?
Marion Delgado.
That's it.
I only recently realized that this happened in sometime like 1947.
No.
we at the time thought it had just happened, because another radical newspaper had reprinted something from Life magazine. A kid put a concrete block or something on a train track and derailed a train. And there's a picture of this adorable little kid grinning from ear to ear, standing by a train track. And his name was Marion Delgado, which we loved, and it was a name we all adopted and used in various ways. So a lot of times, if an article was going to be signed in the paper, we signed it Marion Delgado.
So during this period, you're sort of further along into kind of the, I don't know if you want to call it the true sort of story of the memoir, and that is a tale of coming out, but not an ordinary coming out story.
No, not an ordinary coming out story. While I was in Europe, because I actually didn't get any help from anybody in Stockholm.
Let me go back a second. What was the attitude within the movement towards homosexuality?
It wasn't a fixed attitude, but in general, the New Left was not very welcoming to gay people. And in general, the Weather Organization was not very welcoming to gay people. There were sort of moments when in our sort of hippie experimental moods that would relax, and there were people who had sort of tentative relationships with each other. But actually, at the very same time that Weathermen took over SDS in June of 1969, Stonewall happened. And almost immediately, gay political organizations, there had been some, but it took new ones of younger people like us.
Matach? I don't know how to...
Well, there was the Mattachine Society had existed since the early 50s.
That's one of the oldest, right?
Yeah. But of our generation, after Stonewall, a number of organizations, Gay Activists Alliance, Gay Liberation Front, and shortly some lesbian organizations too.
Did they all feel in alliance with the other factions of the New Left?
Yes and no. Actually, what the existence of those organizations made possible was the chance to be an activist with your own liberation at the center of what you were doing. And gay people abandoned the New Left in large numbers. So
for better or worse, it's clear that the personal is political was a key factor in this whole evolution, right?
That's the way I cut it. Yeah.
So let's get back to your story.
Okay. Well, when Stonewall happened and gay organizations happened and gay people I knew in SDS stopped being part of SDS and started being part of these other things, I was throwing my lot in with the Weathermen, which was a very male-dominated, very kick-ass, you know, macho, motorcycle boots and chains and fighting in the streets.
A lot of posing going on there.
A lot of posing and a lot of, like, not what you think of as, like, gay culture.
Right.
There wasn't a lot of opportunity for me to express myself in that environment. And also, I was confused and I wasn't ready to.
Mm-hmm.
For
younger listeners, you know, things have evolved a lot in those regards. In that regard.
Yeah. on the other hand, when I was in Europe all by myself and I found myself without any resources, I realized that what I could do to survive and also to feel out who I was as a gay person was to make my living through prostitution, which is what I did.
Because you're also only, what, 21, 22?
I was 21.
Yeah.
I had just been cutting cane in Cuba for 2 months. I was tan, you know. I was in good shape.
And I can tell listeners you still have great hair. But I've seen the earlier pictures when your hair was great, too.
Well, it was really, really, really long.
Yeah.
I did that to survive for the, basically I was underground kind of lost from the organization because of my odd odyssey of going to Cuba and then Europe. And then I finally did make my way back to the US, but by that time had lost contact with the organization. And so for that, 8 months or something like that, that's how I survived. And,
in Canada or here?
In Paris and in Canada and then back in New York City.
So then you reconnect with the underground?
Yes.
And what happens then?
The first thing they said was, well, actually, I think the first thing they said was like wide eyes and drop jaws when I told them what I'd been doing.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing they said was, actually, you have no legal problems. You don't need to be underground. We're glad to be back in touch with you, and we want you to be part of us, but you don't need to be living like a fugitive. That was a hard thing to do, living like a fugitive. It wasn't impossible to create false ID, for example, but it took a lot of work. And, you know, you couldn't just waltz in and out of jobs, and, you know, there was a lot of paranoia.
How long was that fugitive or self-described fugitive period
of mine?
Of yours, yeah.
9 months or about 9 months or so.
So you come back, you reconnect, and they ask you to take on a new assignment, so to speak.
Well, it wasn't, for a long time, it wasn't very focused. It was to be an above ground member/supporter. So I would do things like raise money for them. I ended up living back in Chicago where they didn't really have an organizational presence. But when people would be traveling through from one place to another, I might find them a place to stay. I didn't really do much actual work, but actually, the whole organization wasn't doing much actual work. It was just every 6 months or a year setting off a symbolic bombing and then mainly surviving.
So there are two things about this period that sort of interest me reading your book, which, by the way, is called Swords in the Hands of Children, published by Orr Books. And it's out right now. And by the way, I'm speaking with Jonathan Lerner, the author of that book, which is a memoir. One of the things that interested me was during that period, two things were interesting. One is your visit to the main fugitives, which is, say, Billy Ayers, mm-hmm. Bernadine Dorn.
Multiple visits.
And is Jeff Jones out there, too?
Jeff and...
Can you describe that situation?
Well, you mean when I went out to California?
California, yeah.
Well, yeah. There was... the underground did have a presence in the Bay Area. I went from New York out there and reconnected with my old friends and comrades. And I've had many visits with them, including one day when I arrived at the house where Bernadine, Jeff, and Bill were living in a suburban location. and a place I'd visited before. I came in a borrowed car that I thought was not known to the police. And when I drove up to their house, there was a sedan with two guys sitting in it, two middle-aged men. And I pointed this out when it got into the house, and the three of them took one look at it and said, "Pack, let's go." It actually, what was happening at that time, and this is the spring of 1970, was what we came to call the encirclement, and it was an encirclement. There was a series of security lapses had begun to lead the police to where our people were. And so that very morning, the three of them abandoned that house. Other people abandoned apartments. The cars were abandoned. People left the area for a while until they could regroup. That was, to my knowledge, the only time the only time they got close, the FBI got close to finding us. Even then, they actually didn't get any of us. So one or two people, very early in the first months of the underground, one or two people had been arrested. One was fingered by an FBI plant who then, by doing so, had outed himself. And another one was just accidentally recognized on the subway, I think, by an FBI agent. But in general, and one of the things that was counted as a success by us and by a lot of people, including a lot of fans, a lot of people, other people who were activists, was the fact that we managed to keep this organization alive and secret for 7 years.
And you were also struck, though, by the disparity between the massive underground who were living in really horrible conditions, and yet the sort of hierarchy were surviving fairly well on the blandishments of the kind of trendy fellow travelers in the Hollywood kind of California,
something like that. I wouldn't say that the worker bees were living in horrible conditions, but there was a really noticeable class distinction within the organization, which is that's a really good sign, something to watch for if you're ever in an organization. Uh-huh. If the leadership is kind of having dinner at white tablecloth restaurants, yeah, and everybody else is eating at Burger, yeah, King, there's something wrong.
Right. So then you, in the above ground activities in this period, you get back involved with publications, mm-hmm, which is sort of always your strong suit.
It's been my thing. Yeah.
And continues to be.
Yeah.
Right? And that's when I guess the Prairie Fire begins, right?
I was living back in Chicago. I started writing for what we now call an alternate weekly. That was my first real, and actually I had a job working on that paper, and that was my first like really serious journalistic experience, where I was working with people who had actually been to journalism school and were actually trying to keep something afloat financially. I wasn't an author of Prairie Fire. Prairie Fire was a sort of manifesto that
But you arranged for it to be published and all that?
I helped distribute it.
Helped distribute it.
After some years of being underground, after about 5 years of being underground, I think, consciously or not, the leadership began to realize that the organization was more or less irrelevant. The anti-war movement was going away because the war was going away. Much of a connection between these occasional symbolic bombings and anything else. And so in order to try to recapture a place at the head of a movement in their minds, they came up with this idea of writing a manifesto that would be put out to the world and would sort of reestablish them as primary. And it would contain a sort of strategy. It was a document that they wrote. It was the idea was that it would be democratically collectively critiqued and revised by people in the organization and our close friends. And there was some of that. It didn't really change very much. And then it was the organization put together a secret print shop and printed and bound and published this thing. And I as an above ground person in the organization, like a lot of other people, were part of a coordinated distribution that happened at dawn one morning, where these books were dropped at the on the doorsteps of political organizations and publications all over the country. Actually,
do you have any copies?
I do have a copy.
Because I see it online book sites are selling for a lot of money.
Really?
Yeah.
I think I have two. Maybe I sold them. Because it's basically an unreadable document. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, it's nonsense politically.
And would you say that's kind of the beginning of the end, among other things?
Yes, I would say it's the beginning of the end. Because it wasn't just a document. It included a whole strategy, which bizarrely and ironically was a return to that same sort of 1930s worker-focused proletarian organizing, making secondary our concern, which had been very primary for us with the black movement and the condition of black people in this country. And so with this articulated strategy, people like me were instructed to create an above ground organization, also with the name Prairie Fire, and to start doing this kind of organizing.
That's what I was trying to get at earlier. In other words, at that time, it was really a very deceptive kind of move on the part of the hierarchy.
Well, I was deceived. I really believed the idea that it was a document that was being promulgated to provoke open discussion and help a movement focus. But actually, any critiques that were raised were batted away. And it turned out that always in the minds of the leaders who were behind this plot was this idea of creating a front organization, since they were underground and controlling
right.
it like puppets.
Right. And front organizations have a long history in radical movements.
Yeah.
So your disillusionment, was your disillusionment largely a result of your personal journey, you think, or was it a combination of self-discovery and disillusionment? I mean, your book is very much there's a certain aspect of seeing the past through a therapeutic view.
Well, actually, because I see the whole history psychologically, and I see what motivated us, not just me, everyone,
right.
as their individual
right.
psyches. But,
by the way, there was a famous sociologist at the time, roughly at the time, who wrote a book called Conflict of Generations, and he tried to reduce the entire thing to a generational conflict.
I didn't know that.
Louis Foyer was the name. But anyway, go ahead.
My disillusionment was actually, it was more political, because I felt I had disagreed with that strategy of Prairie Fire. I had disagreed with some of the content politically of Prairie Fire. Mm-hmm. My disagreements were not accepted. Out of loyalty, I just swallowed, my own critique and went on as a participating member. When I was told about this larger strategy of creating a front organization, I objected to it as being manipulative and also just impractical. I didn't think it was going to work. I still went along with it out of loyalty. I mean, when you're on a track and your whole identity is that you're a revolutionary and you're going to do this, and eventually you're going to be part of taking over, taking state power and running the country, it's not easy to sort of step back. It takes a lot of provocation to step back and realize that your whole direction has been wrong. So, but I didn't, when that strategy finally proved to be a failure, I felt manipulated and used, and also very chagrined that I had manipulated other people, and sort of passed this dumb strategy along and tried to help implement it. And so I felt, burned personally. And that's where it segues into the personal,
mm-hmm.
because so much of the reason I was not the not why was I a radical or why was I an activist, that I would have been a radical or an activist because of when I where I come from and the period of history I came up in, and the fact that I was going to civil rights demonstrations when I was 13 years old. But the fact that I was in SDS and then in Weatherman was all personal, really. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people were angry and militant and in the streets. A very small number of them did what we did. And that's where the personal thing comes in. Why I did it was I was in love with my friend and he was doing it and he wanted me to be there with him. And mm-hmm. I got something from that. Why other people did it, I'm sure everybody has their own narrative,
right.
whether they're willing to articulate it or not.
Right. And I have to say for listeners that you're very self-critical. You take full responsibility for what took place. And, it's not a self-aggrandizing memoir at all. What I'd like to ask you sort of for the last part here is, I know Mark Rudd, who was well-known, especially during the Columbia protests, provided a blurb, a positive blurb for your book. What's been the connection since then with some of the other prominent
members? The other people?
Yeah.
Of the prominent people, Mark, I have one really close friend.
You don't have to name names.
Yeah, who I've known since I joined SDS, and we were together through a lot of that, the pre-underground period, and saw each other a number of times when he was underground. There are a number of people, including Mark, for example, who I'm very fond of and I don't see often and don't have much to do with, but another person in that category is Kathy Wilkerson, who lives nearby here and who I just recently saw for the first time in probably 30 years. And
who, by the way, was at the townhouse during the explosion.
It was actually her father's house.
It was her father's house, that's right, right.
So there are people I feel fine about, and then there are a lot of people I have had no contact with since the late 70s. There are a few people who, if I never saw again, it would be too soon. I can say all of the people who were in the leadership are people I haven't seen for a very long time, and I'm not particularly interested in seeing. I mean, I don't...
It was a combination, again, of the personal and the political in the sense that you disagree with them at the time of the way they were taking the organization, but also they didn't treat you well.
They didn't treat me well. at this point, I'm not angry anymore, really, which is why it was actually, it was a lot of fun to write this book. It was, to my surprise, it came very easily, and I think that's because enough time has gone by that I don't have any animus toward anybody, and if I don't agree with this person or that person about how I see the history we shared, mm-hmm. There's no implication of that. It's, these aren't people I'm hanging out with, so it doesn't matter.
Have you read many of the other memoirs of the period?
Not many, no.
Have you read Kathy's, Kathy Wilkerson's?
Not yet, no.
And, of course, there are secondary works. I forget his first name, but Eckstein.
Art Eckstein.
Yeah.
I have read his. His is a good book. It's called... Days of Bad Moon Rising.
Oh, Bad Moon Rising, right? Yale University.
And it's actually based. He is a historian, and his book is based in information from some recently released FBI files. And it's about how crazy we made the FBI and how ineffectual they were in trying to catch us. But it's also quite a good documentary history of the organization. He's a historian. I'm a memoirist. It's two different things.
There's a archive at some university, right? Is it Wisconsin?
Wisconsin has an archive, and these FBI papers, I think, are now at the University of Maryland, where Art Eckstein is. At Wisconsin, there's an archive.
You've talked about how you feel about the whole period. There must be some embarrassment as well as pride. I mean, or no?
Yeah, both.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's kind of... a mixed thing, ultimately.
Yeah.
Did you tell people, all those years afterwards where you're doing completely other things, was it often a topic of conversation or did you avoid it?
No. And it wasn't, for a long time it was still sort of percolating and I was working it out in my mind and probably feeling worse about it than I feel now. I really think that... when I remember what was going on in the late 60s politically in this country and internationally, partly as a result of the operation of this country, I think that we and everyone who was moved to activism through sort of idealism, you know, it was the thing to do, just as it is the thing to do now.
Exactly. Many of the members are either teachers or activists of a kind. I mean, I can't think of anybody who was from that who actually has gone right wing. I mean, David Horowitz, but he wasn't really. He wasn't Weather.
He was no.
He was. In fact, he exaggerates his role in things.
Yeah.
Actually.
No, I mean, people. It was the commitment. The idealism was real, and the commitment was real. The parts that I regret are the things we individually did, such as dissociating ourselves from our critical faculties and following people who were no smarter than we were and had stupid ideas, and also the risks that we took and the risks we put other people at, which were considerable. You know, I'm both proud of it and chagrined about it, I guess you'd say.
That may be a good place to end. I've been talking with Jonathan Lerner, who has published his memoir of his time involved with the Weather Underground and SDS. It's published by Orr Books, and he is going to have a book signing here in Hudson June 11th at the Opera House at what time?
5 o'clock.
5 o'clock. Jonathan, thanks so much for giving us this time to hear about your book.
Thank you, Tom.
It's been fun. I mean, I enjoyed reading it and talking about it.
Great.
Thank you very much.